Hi, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 342 of the podcast, Austin-flavored episode. These two segments that are coming up today were both recorded in Austin during South by Southwest 2016. We are speaking with Holly Herrick, who is the Associate Artistic Director of the Austin Film Society. She's been there for about 4 years. We're going to talk a little bit about the Austin Film Society with her. She's somebody I knew, she was like a colleague slash acquaintance friend that I'd known for going 6 or 7 years, I guess. So it was nice to finally bring her on the podcast. And she's married to a friend of the podcast and a friend of mine who's been on this podcast a couple of times, Michael Tully, who is a filmmaker. His most recent film was Ping Pong Summer, which he came on to the podcast and talked about. And the film before that was Septian, which he also came on and talked about. It was Septian, I believe, which is how I was introduced to two friends that remain to this day. Owner, who has been on the show many times, but although not long for a long time, and Robert Longstreet. So the three of them played brothers in that film. Michael and Holly have been married for quite some time, and this is Holly's first appearance on the podcast. And then following that, Tim League, who, of course, is the founder of Alamo Drafthouse, that chain of theaters, which is, by the way, coming to New York this summer, or to Brooklyn this summer. That's the plan. There's already an Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers, but this is the first one to come to the city. Tim is also the founder of Drafthouse Films, which is a distribution company, which, among many other films, has distributed two of the Joshua Oppenheimer films, Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. Both of those films were highlighted on past episodes of this podcast when Joshua Oppenheimer was on. So it's nice to bring Tim League on finally, and we do talk about Joshua Oppenheimer and much, much more. Tim is also the founder of Fantastic Fest, which is the U.S.'s largest genre film festival, I believe. And so all those things are discussed on the segment with Tim League coming up in just a little bit. We had, when I say we, Tim was one of my panelists. It's at South by Southwest. That I had on this program that I did called Indie Film and the Death of the Theatrical, and Tim was just one of those panelists. So we did the panel a few Sundays ago, and then afterwards, Tim and I walked over to his office, and we knocked out this segment. So it worked out real well. So thank you to Tim and everybody at Drafthouse Films for helping to make this happen. Thank you to Holly, too, and the folks at the Austin Film Society. So it's a very Austin-flavored episode, so that's all coming up. I'd like to just, first of all, talk about something that's come up in the film news in the last week, which is this documentary called Vaxxed, which Tribeca Film Festival was supposed to program in their festival this year, which is coming up in a few weeks, in just a couple of weeks, actually, as I speak. The Tribeca Film Festival, which runs from the 13th of April through, I think, the 24th. Anyway, the closing, I think it was the closing night film, in fact. I could be wrong, but it was called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe, which, you know, is very anti-vaccine, and which was a documentary directed by this guy, Andrew Wakefield, who is a former doctor. His medical license was taken away during the course of his career, having been so coming out against vaccines, of course. There's a whole conversation that could be just had, regardless of your beliefs about vaccines and whether or not potentially is a cause of autism. You know, that argument has been largely discounted. But, you know, one still should remain somewhat skeptical when the medical community, which is so pro-vaccine, one should take anything that the medical community says with some skepticism as well, because, of course, the pharmaceutical industry is tightly knit to the medical community, and they have an agenda of their own. You know, I'm just saying. Now, I have a child. He was vaccinated, but it was during the time when this conversation about being opposed to vaccines started to really come to the fore. We still went ahead and had our child vaccinated, but we did it with a little bit more information, and we spread them out a little bit more. And, you know, it was a decision based on thought, conversation, and research, et cetera, et cetera. And so what happened here at the Tribeca Film Festival is the programmers there included this film, Vaxxed, directed by this former doctor, Andrew Wakefield, into the festival. And there was a backlash. There was, for instance, former FilmWax Radio guest and filmmaker Penny Lane, who directed Our Nixon. She publicly denounced the film and publicly questioned Tribeca Film Festival about programming it. And De Niro made a public statement as though, I don't know, you know, look, De Niro has, as he's publicly said, one of his children has autism. So he's very public about that. And so his take on it and his argument was that this might be a controversial film, but it deserves to be part of the conversation, regardless of how controversial that it is. But with the further pressure, and I don't know who the pressure came from or who made the final decision, but it was announced yesterday, Sunday, that they were pulling the film from the festival. So, you know, it doesn't look great for the festival. It doesn't look great for De Niro that they all caved in. In a sense, even though they realized that they made a big mistake and they tried to fix it with keeping the film in, so they didn't look foolish, and now they're pulling the film. Nobody looks good as a result. In fact, Andrew Wakefield, the director, put this on his website, vaxthemovie.com. To our dismay, we learned today about the Tribeca Film Festival's decision to reverse the official selection of Vaxxed. Robert De Niro's original defense of the film happened Friday after a one-hour conversation between De Niro and Bill Posey, the congressman who has interacted directly and at length with the CDC whistleblower William Thompson, and whose team has scrutinized the documents that prove fraud at the CDC. It is our understanding that persons from an organization affiliated with the festival have made unspecified allegations against the film, claims that we were given no opportunity to challenge or redress. We were denied the due process. And then he goes on to say, we have just witnessed yet another example of the power of corporate interests censoring free speech, art, and truth. Tribeca's action will not succeed in denying the world access to the truth behind the film Vaxxed. We're grateful to the many thousands of people who have already mobilized, including doctors, scientists, educators, and the autistic community. So what's your take on it? I think that they should have just kept it in there and not bowed to pressure, frankly, once they decided to keep it in. You know, their argument was that, well, this is going to be a controversial film. We recognize that, and we want to make a conversation happen around it. Well, then just stick to it, you know? It's very strange to me. Very strange. That's the controversy in a nutshell. So there you go. Let me know what you think. I'm interested in knowing. You can put your feelings and thoughts and reactions to this whole thing on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/filmwaxradio, or you can tweet directly at filmwaxradio. Be interested in knowing what you think. And if you come up with something, maybe we'll follow up on the next show or so with your responses. I'll read them out loud on the show. Vaxxed, from cover-up to catastrophe. Okay, today's show is sponsored by the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film Program, which offers a 2-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop, lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan of your personal projects. Then students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories and an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more details. Thank you to the Vermont College of Fine Arts, MFA in Film, for sponsoring yet another episode of the podcast. Oh, by the way, one last thing I wanted to mention. I was over at the Bushwick neighborhood. I think it's Bushwick or far east Williamsburg. I'm really not sure. But I was in a place called Cave. I think it's a coffee shop called Cave. I believe that's how they pronounce it. And there was this fabulous musician playing. His name is Lucas Eberle. He was in the 2001 Planet of the Apes and a bunch of other roles. Anyway, he's also this incredible musician. Piano player and musician. So I heard him and I was really swept away from by his work and really impressed. So I put my name on his mailing list and I got an email from him later and saying, you know, that I could download the show. And then I wrote him back and I said, look, you know, I'd like to put your music on the show. And he said, I listen to your, I'm already a subscriber to your podcast. That'd be great. So it was this really nice little instance that that happened in a most organic of ways. So the music you're going to be hearing today is all brought to you by this very talented musician and actor named Luke Burrell. And so if you like what you hear, you can seek him out on Facebook or online. I'm sure you won't have a problem. His name is Luke Burrell, E-B-E-R-L. Or you can also look under Lucas Elliott Burrell, because he goes by both names and is an actor and a musician, but he's in a huge talent. So please do check it out and try to catch him playing live. He's from Brooklyn. Thank you very much. Okay, let's get into my first conversation, the first segment here of this podcast, and it is with Austin Film Society's own Holly Herrick. So you ordered 5 Big Macs, and they actually, when you got to the...
No. We corrected the problem at that moment, but we almost were served 5 Big Macs with only pickles on them, which is really just a triple-decker roll with pickles.
It actually sounds good right about now for some reason. I'm not sure what
it's
that
It's like
is,
a barbecue but... side. You know, speaking of Austin, it's like it's sort of what you get on... You get the white bread and the pickles.
The white bread. Yeah. And then and the wet naps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're sitting in the Austin Convention Center, second level across from the McDonald's lounge. So that's what we're going on. Where was this McDonald's drive-thru, by the way? Where did you grow up?
Well, we were coming back from Six Flags. No. King's Dominion. King's Dominion in Virginia. I lived in Maryland. I was.
Oh, you're from Maryland, too.
Yes. My husband and I, Michael Tully, we are both from rural Maryland, central Maryland.
But your families weren't like these two Scott Glossermen.
Hi. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm going to head up to the green room.
Yeah,
testing.
We're podcasting. Join
this
the fun.
This is Holly Herrick from
I'm
the Austin
Holly.
Film Society. She's the director
of
the film. And this is Caitlin. She's a producer on Donald Cried.
Okay.
There is a space. I'm going to get there at 1:30 because I guess there's something going on there until 1:30. He's on the panel. That was a walk by, a kind of. So I was trying to get out of my the term where you have these two families that are like the Tully and the Herricks that are, you know, it's like the Kennedys. I don't know. Where
no,
in Maryland.
No, not quite like that.
Where
actually,
when you if you want whatever you want on those buns. And I'm referring to McDonald's buns. You get, you know, without question.
I feel like we're giving McDonald's a lot of airtime. This is like exactly we're playing into this whole scheme.
That's right.
We're playing
that's
into it.
Planting seeds. Planting seeds. I need my sponsorships, you know. Okay. Look, Holly, you are artistic director of
Yes, that's right. I've got a super weird title, but essentially I'm the associate artistic director at the Austin Film Society, which is founded by Richard Linklater in 1985. He's our artistic director at board level, and then we have – and then our executive director is Rebecca Campbell, who's been the executive director for 18 years, which is pretty awesome. I got there 4 years ago. I was at the Hamptons Film Festival before that, and this crazy weird position opened up, which was overseeing the Film Society's exhibition and artist services programs. So kind of linking together all the artistic programs of the organization under one department, and I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And so had to see if it was right for me, and it turns out it's been a pretty amazing experience.
Because it's now over 2 years? Easily 2 years. More.
I actually almost 4 years.
You came earlier, right?
Hmm?
Didn't you come earlier and get the lay of the land, and then Michael followed you down like a year or two late? No, I'm making this up, I guess.
That sounds great. No, it actually didn't happen like that at all. I came down from New York to interview and got the job, and like we moved a month later. It was so fast.
It was fast.
I really didn't think it was going to happen, and then suddenly I was in Austin, and it just was this crazy fit. It was just one of those things where it was the perfect fit for me, and it was, I think, the great fit for AFS, and it just all came together, and we moved a month later, and it was nuts. And I had spent, literally the only time I'd spent in Texas was attending South by Southwest. So, yeah. It, you know, it was quite a leap geographically from places where I've lived before. But the film community here is so terrific, and that was sort of the main pull, was knowing that there was this, you know, I loved the New York independent film community. I really felt very comfortable in that world, and but I knew that Austin also had this really warm and wonderful and collaborative film community, and a lot of the artists, I really respected their work and sort of the really outside the box stuff that was being done. Of course, you know, also working with Richard Linklater seemed like that would be pretty great, and I was right about that.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you were. As a matter of fact, one of the four films I saw yesterday was Richard Linklater, Dream is Destiny.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it occurred to me as I was sitting there, I remember the name Louis Black, not the comedian, but the one who found...
Founder of South By, one of the founders
of South By. And that's because last year, where I was staying with Jason Cortland and Julia Halperin, friends of mine, and I had a...
That's my neighborhood, man.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, we live just a short walk from them.
Well, you're not terribly far, probably a mile or so from where Lewis lives.
Yes, that's right. Because down the street,
because they lent me their bike, and I had an hour with John Sayles. He was there last year, here I should say, and he was staying in Lewis Black's new house, and so I didn't know who Lewis Black was because I'm an idiot. You know, I don't know the founder of South by Southwest. So we're in his house, and John says, "Let's go down to Lewis's. They got a new screening room down there." He's got this incredible screening room at that lower level of this house. It's a beautiful house. And we're sitting there doing the interview for like an hour. And I finally, it's not one of those cases where he's a John Sayles. He's a talker. But I realized that was Lewis Black's house.
Yeah. No, it's a great place. He's got the most amazing collection of posters. And Lewis is Lewis directed Richard Linklater, Dream is Destiny, which is a film about Rick deciding to stay in Austin and make films here and sort of his artistic growth from his beginnings and really in Houston, and then sort of how he and Austin kind of came up together and how he developed the film community here, and also how he managed to stay outside the fray, really, of, you know, what's happening in... He never, like, spent a long time in L.A. He really worked with the studio system, but worked with them from here in Austin. And the story is just really interesting, and I think kind of a must-see for any filmmaker to understand that there are different ways of working. And I really think Rick is an exception, and not everybody can make that work, but it's a wonderful story. And Lewis also, you know, not only is he co-founder of South by Southwest, but also of the Austin Chronicle. And the Austin Chronicle is just this amazing publication that we have here in Austin. You know, this is nowadays, I think people forget that all those alternative weeklies used to be independently owned, and now they're not, except for in Austin. We're one of the few cities in the country that has an independent alternative weekly that's published here in Austin, all Austin writers, and has an incredibly robust film section. The Chronicle writers, they have dedicated critics, Marjorie Baumgarten, Kimberly Jones, who's also the managing editor. There's a whole staff of film critics there and film writers, and they cover the film scene intently and intelligently, and are just, it's the paper is so unique for that reason.
Yeah.
And it's just rare nowadays to have a paper like that gives such weight to film. And I think that's a huge part of why we have this amazing film community here.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So it's actually like a girder in a way.
Yeah, I mean, just keeps the conversation relevant all the time. You know, the fact that we're showing, if we're doing like a, you know, 80s series on 35mm at our single screen theater, they're covering those movies every week. They're covering the repertory happenings. They're covering the new releases. So it sort of keeps everything. It's film culture. You know, it's a film culture kind of living and breathing through the writing, and then sort of through the engagement with the different exhibitors in the community.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say there's a lot going on behind the scenes, but then you also do a lot of stuff for the public. Right.
Oh, the Film Society?
Yeah,
we have a single screen art house theater. We're kind of like a pop-up in this. It's north. It's one of the satellite venues. It's called the Marquesa. So we pop up in this venue that is north of, you know, north central. It's just north of the university. And we show films there like four or five nights a week, mostly repertory, but also new independent art house releases. So like the film that we had,
like a buzz screening or something, or like a new film.
We do. It's sort of like, you know, a limited run. If you were going to, it's like something that would happen, you know, at Lincoln Center, where they would do, you know, four or five screenings of a smaller international title or independent film, we'll do maybe two screenings of something instead of it getting
a 7-day.
Yeah, a 7-day run. But usually these films aren't booked here in Austin. So an example would be right before South By, we had the new Philippe Garrel film In the Shadow of Women, amazing new film by Philippe Garrel. And, you know, we showed that in a single screening, but we had like 90 people come out for it, which is what in other cities of this size you might get that in a week of a run. So our goal this year is to expand our exhibition program into a two-screen full-time art house theater, and we're actually in a campaign to have that theater open by the fall,
like a crowdsource type thing.
It's more of a mini capital campaign that we're sort of just received. We announced at the Texas Film Awards, which is our big gala fundraiser, that we received the largest ever gift in the history of our organization to get this thing off the ground by these two wonderful people who've been major supporters of ours since the beginning. So it's just about having that engaged community around film who wants to see this happen.
There's a real sense of engagement and ownership. Mm-hmm. All that, you know, that goes along with what you guys are doing, which is a big part. It's hard to make that kind of thing happen in a city as sprawled out as big in like New York.
I mean, New York has such a great film community, and I feel like it all kind of comes together around the screenings, you know, around BAM Cinematheque retrospectives and Lincoln Center and the New York Film Festival and all these amazing year-round repertory happenings at Film Forum and everywhere. So I feel like the film community sort of exists in the theater there, and that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, we just had a little
bird fly by.
Oh, we did.
I mean, and that's the same thing here in Austin, really. You know, it's just on a smaller scale. When we show films at the Marquesa, you'll see, you know, a quarter of the audience is filmmakers or crew, you know.
That's great, though.
It is great. But it's not dissimilar from how it works in New York. We just have it on a much smaller scale.
I understand. So the Texas Film Awards is coming right up.
We just had it. Thursday night. It's the night before South by Southwest. And it's a jammer. It's a big, big gala event.
But the timing is kind of funny, though. It's like, okay, come off that, and then you're...
Well, for us, it's funny, but it makes a lot of sense, you know, just to have it all the energy kind of happen in that moment, sort of the energy towards being internationally facing, you know, on the Thursday night before South By. A lot of journalists are in town and are able to cover it.
Right. I think last year I was potentially coming to it, as a matter of fact, now that you mentioned it, because they were vetting somebody that I was interested in, and I was emailed with their people, but it didn't end up happening.
Well,
because I got here early. I always come a little early.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good reason to come a day early. Uh-huh. This year we honored Carol Burnett, which was pretty amazing.
Did you meet?
Oh yeah. I met her throughout the weekend. She was here,
amazing.
She was, I mean, just lovely.
Why her?
She is born and raised in San Antonio.
Oh right, she's a Texan girl.
Yeah, she moved to California. I think when she was 8 or 9 years old.
According to Laura, her grandmother and her moved to. I think it was her grandmother moved her. To Hollywood when she was young.
And, that's right.
They would go to the movies together. I think that was the story. She tells it at every opportunity. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's a great story.
No, it's true. She was raised by her grandmother here in San Antonio, and then they moved out to California together. Right. So she was from a really dirt poor area of San Antonio. And she told a story at the Texas Film Awards about the house that she grew up in, which has now been turned into a school. Oh. Her grandmother would let her ride her roller skates inside, and she can still see the tracks, the roller skate tracks on the wooden floor.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Carol Burnett tells that story, so it's got to be true.
Did she tug her ear?
She did tug her ear.
She has to. It's a crowd pleaser.
She did it when she went off stage. She did it at our little press conference. Ugh,
she's got to be turning 80.
She's over 80.
She is over 80.
Yeah. She got a SAG Achievement Award this year.
Uh-huh.
Amazing.
What's the relationship with the South by Southwest, which is an enormous thing, although the film component is probably about, even though it's still a little large probably for Austin, it's not, really doesn't represent the actual big, the overall festival. That's a huge thing. But your relationship
yeah,
with
sort of interconnected
as opposed
South
to
by.
Austin Film Festival as opposed to Fantastic Fest.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Others.
There's it's funny because I there is always sort of the outside impression that because it's Austin we're all the same thing.
There are
actually different organizations.
Right.
But the Austin Film Society shares a founder with South by. So Lewis Black was one of our founding board members. So Richard Linklater is our founder, but he started it with, you know, three founding board members, and Lewis Black was one of them. So from the very beginning, Lewis has been on the board, and so he has a permanent board seat, and he's one of the founders of South by Southwest. And so we and Janet Pearson also was previously on our board. She's we rotate our board members off and on, so she's on, permanently on our advisory board, and then sometimes on our board of directors. So we share leadership, and as a result, we are a community partner of theirs. They're big supporters of what we do through our grant program. They are an annual sponsor of the Austin Film Society. So we work very closely with them, and at every opportunity we find ways to make sure that they are, you know, we're supporting filmmakers who can then in turn be recognized by South by Southwest, or that we're have a presence at this festival that helps people understand how robust and great the film community is here. So we work closely together in that way. Of course, their programming and everything is completely separate from what we do, but we're close partners and friends. And then, of course, the Alamo Draft House is also a supporter of ours and has been for many years. We used to do all of our programming at Alamo Draft Houses, and then we just figured we needed to do, you know, twice as much programming, and now even more.
Right.
So,
and the autonomy, I'm sure, is good too. A little bit of the autonomy.
Yeah, it's good. You know, having our own space has been really important to us, just because we do kind of have our own vibe, and so they've been amazing supporters of ours over the years, and Tim and Carrie League have been also sort of been leaders at Austin Film Society, either through their advisory board affiliation and in other things. So the community here is extremely collaborative and friendly. And AFS, because we support the filmmakers here and because we support the infrastructure, we work closely with a lot of these other people who are doing amazing and innovative things in Austin, like the Draft House, like Nicholas Gonda and Tug, like many of the production companies. And yeah, we kind of we touch a lot of different organizations and people.
And how many years has the Austin Film Society been around?
This is the end of our 30th anniversary year. So we've been around for 30 years. So we predate a lot of the other film happenings and film things in Austin, because we were, you know, started sort of at the beginning of this new era of film in Austin.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Holly. Holly Herrick, the Associate Artistic Director of the Austin Film Society. And year four and growing. I'm sure it's really nice to see you finally do this together.
Yeah, I know. This is great. And, thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Trying to get Tim League on the show for a long time, so when he finally when the opportunity came up and he agreed to be on my panel just a couple of weeks ago, it was a natural thing. I just asked his team, can we follow up and do a one-on-one also that same day, and they said of course, and so they arranged it. So thank you to the team over there at Drafthouse Film / Alamo Drafthouse for making it happen. I think Tim League is one of the outspoken pioneers of the independent film in the current day, and just he will speak his mind and he's very, I think, progressive with his ideas. And so it was my honor to meet up with him and to have him on the podcast finally. So let's just get right to it. Here's my conversation with Tim League. Thanks. I was nervous only because I'm not typically, you know, I do a lot of, obviously, interviewing, and I also do Q&As all the time, and I'll even do a live thing with a few people, but it's, you know, it's usually around one film or something. This is a little bit more, you know, industry related to us, but I was a little just hoping that people would engage and get the, you know, and that went, so it went well. And thank you again for doing that.
My pleasure.
Especially during this week. I don't, I mean, I guess you're not officially, you don't have an official capacity at South By, but you must be just as busy.
I have a lot of little tangential things.
Right.
You know, we had a gallery show opening and we're supporting the Greasy Strangler, and we have a very small crew here doing that.
When you say supporting, I did hear things about this particular Midnight movie, and I'm
so I'm one of the producers. So,
oh, very good.
There's four of us that put in a bit of money and put the budget together, and so we've got the Greasy Strangler crew staying at my house. We're doing a press day for them. We did a party the other night after the screening. So
oh, very
that
good.
Type of
I'm
thing.
Hearing snippets. I think as we walked into the conference, I was hearing throughout. Right, it was the gentleman in the winter coat.
Yes.
Is he involved in that film?
He is the Greasy Strangler.
He's the guy.
They were recording the DVD commentary down there.
Oh,
so
all right.
To, you know, since everybody's in town,
this is tell me then just as a like a like as an example or a case study about this. Let's take this film because it's is this its world premiere first of all?
Is it the opening film of Sundance Midnights?
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of a. Okay. Encore screening here at South by Southwest.
Right. And then it's since you're already making the DVD, is it just the timing because this guy's here and you're just, it just makes sense to do it at the top of the.
We're frugal, you know, so everybody's here. We have recording equipment here. Why not? Because Jim lives in London and flying him around, it's not that easy. And so these types of things are better done when everybody's in one room together. So we thought we'd save some bucks and do it now. That's really all it is, being frugal.
Frugal. And efficient in a way,
yes,
too.
Yes, being efficient is a more complimentary word.
Yeah, but I'm thinking it's so efficient, even the taking the economics out of the equation, it's still it's just such an efficient way to use the time. And and it's fresh in their heads because they're that much closer to the finish of the production, the anecdotes, whatever it is they're sharing. I don't know. So, and there's a momentum that's built in the festivals that they're built around their excitement about talking about the film and the way they, so it's a good idea, let alone the fact that the DVD could come out in a matter of months anyway, given how quickly sometimes.
This is probably built for the fall. I think we're going to do some theatrical in October and then, you know, I don't know, DVD months after that.
Mm. Well, tell me, just to wrap up the Greasy Strangler, because I'm now curious about it because I did hear people were talking about it. There's already a buzz about it. That it's kind of outrageous, of course.
It's outrageous, but it's a filmmaker that we got to know through Fantastic Fest. So he had two of his shorts at Fantastic Fest years ago, and we adore his work.
Who is it?
His name is Jim Hosking.
Okay.
Short filmmaker, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then a buddy of mine and I, we put together this program called ABCs of Death, which is a vehicle for us to take emerging genre filmmakers and give them a letter of the alphabet, and every 4 minutes there's a death by that letter. So Jim did G is for Grandpa in ABCs of Death 2, and it was my favorite segment in that compilation. So he had a feature script. He's not done a feature before, and the ABCs team, me and my co-producer Ant, saw it and liked it, and then we brought in Ben Wheatley.
I love him.
And big Elijah Wood as the fourth producer. So we all put in a quarter of the budget, and we made Jim's first feature.
okay, let's go to the videotape. Now I have to see it. And I was just an enormous fan of Ben Wheatley, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So all four of us came to it
right.
saying, this is challenging material, but Jim is a phenomenal director, and he's got such a unique vision. It's like sort of a diseased and mutated Wes Anderson universe. Like, everything is as precise as that. Mm-hmm. Every last detail of the mm-hmm. set design and the costumes he's meticulous about, but he deals in stranger, darker territory.
We wouldn't call him Twee.
Definitely not Twee.
Well, as we're sitting and recording this, it's South by Southwest 2016, and we're in the offices of Drafthouse Films and Alamo. I guess this is, you run everything out of here. It makes sense. But you were mentioning during the panel, and I didn't know about this, but that Drafthouse is going through something of a change, or it's mm-hmm. merging with which company?
Radius.
Radius Films. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's funny because Tom Quinn, who started Radius under the Weinstein Company, he was the guy that pressured me into releasing my first film and starting the company in the first place. Because Four Lions, our first movie, was something he wanted to buy, but his boss at the time didn't want to do it because it was a jihadi suicide bomber comedy, mm-hmm. and it's a little touchy. Mm-hmm. And so he held my hand for the first release that we had, and we've always had a very tight relationship. And he was ready to move on, and we took this as an opportunity to make a stronger company together.
Mm-hmm. So these two companies are coming together, create a bigger entity, basically.
Yeah. So we'll still do.
Where are they based, by the way?
They're in New York.
Okay.
And we have a small office in Los Angeles for Drafthouse Films, so we'll keep a presence in LA and New York.
That's great. And meanwhile, also there's the Drafthouse coming to Brooklyn.
Yes, mm-hmm. sometime this summer. Hopefully
really?
Sooner rather than
okay.
later.
Right.
Yeah, we're already starting to hire, so that's a sign.
I did see something about that. Yeah, Christina is a friend.
She's great.
Yeah. And there's been a one in Yonkers, but it was interesting. She was telling me how, even though a lot of people who listen to this show have very specific ideas of the Alamo Drafthouse mm-hmm. model and the kinds of films that comes out of that they run, but it's also something that works with, has to work in the real world. So that particular one in the Yonkers, for instance, she was mentioning that it had a more mainstream, bigger budget films were playing in that theater just because otherwise you wouldn't get quite the same. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't get people coming out quite as much.
We still support some indie films there, but mm-hmm. it's tougher to get an audience. But we've been building it. I mean, uh-huh. that's the thing. We have a theater in Winchester, Virginia, which is an incredibly small market and is very conservative.
Right.
But yet they were able to start up a weekly film club series.
Interesting.
And so they're playing the most esoteric out there art, foreign language documentaries, and getting 150 people every, I think it's every Wednesday. So
that's amazing.
It can be done. You just have to scale it to the market.
Right, and the various degrees of how much grassroots work you're doing, how literally.
It always takes a lot of grassroots
work. True. One of the things you were talking about is when you take on a smaller film, whether it's a documentary or perhaps in a foreign language film or what have you, I guess it would be that much harder to take on a foreign language film because those filmmakers are less likely to be around to help partner with you in
sure.
a very basic way, but they really do rely on you. The let's say smaller, lower budget films and documentaries would really rely on you guys to help partner with them to get the word out and to help promote the films and get audiences out. Do they understand that, you know, you don't have to do that? And that, like, in other words, there are a lot of films with huge marketing budgets and get reviewed all over the place, and that you don't really have to do as much work. Wouldn't it be easier, in other words, just to do those films or show those films or program those
sure.
films?
Sure, and we do some of those. It's
yeah.
always
no,
a mix
I know
you
do.
Us,
no, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah,
I'm
talking
those
about
are,
the
those
typical,
are always easier.
But even
yeah.
the typical Magnolia film or mm-hmm. IFC or Sony Class, maybe a little bigger, but, you know, the marketing budgets are substantial enough where you don't have to, like, be, you know, working on that 24/7.
Although, you know, you take a movie like Midnight Special, you know, it's a middle movie,
right.
one of those rare middle movies that gets released
yes.
now. We actually do spend a lot of work on those movies because it's a director we love, Jeff Nichols, and
mm-hmm.
we've liked all of his movies. We like this film. And so we feel like our audience is going to respond to this, so we'll do a lot of promotional efforts,
right.
even though it's got a big studio budget behind it. And we measure by trying to over-index on our market share. So, you know, like Hail Caesar was another one where mm-hmm. We're the number 22 circuit in America right now in terms of our just our overall size. But for Hail Caesar, we were like number 7 or number 8 because we got behind it in a big way.
Oh, I see. Right. In other words, in the other owner theaters chains are just throwing it up on the screen.
Right.
And relying on the popcorn sales. So. Mm-hmm. That's a good. I was going to try to spend a day because I missed Hail Caesar and The Witch. Mm-hmm. It was my intention to spend a day before I got here. Going to see one of those two, trying to find a theater that was playing both of those, going to the first and then sneaking into the second. Do you mind that?
I don't mind. That's fine.
I was saying to my I was saying to my son, who's 12, I said, because we tried to get, I took him to the movies, and, you know, he's 11, so we were going to see, this is in New York, and we were going to see, we wanted to go see Zootopia. Yeah, and I was not in Manhattan. It was in a smaller area, Queens or something. And I took them to there, and they were sold out. I couldn't believe it because usually I don't have that experience with kids' movies on a weekend night. But it was in one of those small theaters that you mentioned that are now, I think it was you, maybe it was Scott, who where there are fewer seats, but they recline, they're leather, all this stuff now. But so I didn't know that this theater was like that. So sold out. Fortunately, we're playing, what's the panda movies?
Kung Fu Panda 3.
3D. So that was coming up. So, Jacob, we have to be flexible here. So we went to that, and I said, but you know what we can do if you want to? Because, you know, we'll sneak into the other one after because they're kind of close to you. He goes, you can't do that. That's not honest.
He has a stronger moral compass than you do.
Well, growing up in New York, man, in the 70s, you know, this is what we did. But it was also a novelty. When I was a kid, and maybe this was your experience too, and I'm curious after this to let you talk about how you got into, you know, opening movie theaters. But the multiplex living in Queens where I grew up was this novelty. So when all of a sudden they started to sprout up, this was like, and a couple of our big theaters or our palaces, whatever, would become a multiplex all of a sudden, even if it was 2 screens or 3, you were like, this is incredible. They didn't have this rigorous security system. You could just go in and, you know, it wasn't ideal, but if 10 minutes of the film were over, whatever.
My favorite thing I would do growing up was buying a ticket to a PG movie and then going to see an R-rated movie. So making that switch, making the lateral move to when I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old.
You're even more evolved than I at that age, clearly savvy. Yeah, there is one memory of going into Manhattan and going in. I was in probably still in junior high, maybe high school, early high school, and Alien was playing, and they were asking, what's your age? And just saying 17, and then, you know, obviously knowing they were being complicit, but letting us in.
Right.
So it was a different time. Anyway, so what was the story? Because I haven't done the due diligence to that extent on terms of the idea of opening theaters. For some reason, I'm guessing that it was not planned, that you sort of fell into it. I don't know why I feel that way.
There wasn't a lot of planning. There was a week of planning. So I've always loved movies. You know, I grew up when the mom-and-pop video stores were sprouting up everywhere, and so I watched a lot of movies on the weekends with friends, and then when I went into college, I started watching better movies. I was watching pretty trashy movies. I was getting in. I was becoming a cinephile. Like, right. I just got in with a different set of friends, and there was an art house theater near campus, and we would go there a lot.
Where was that?
Houston.
Okay.
But then I was studying engineering, and I took a job with Shell Oil, and I did that for 2 years and knew that I really didn't like it. Like, too late in the game, realized that I had squandered my education and studied something that I just fell into because I was good at math. So on my way to work was an abandoned movie theater, and then one day there was a for lease sign on it, and that for lease sign triggered something in me that I just never thought that a human being, like a regular person, could own a movie theater. So I went to a bar that weekend with friends, and I just was pitched. Waxing poetic on the idea. And then a week later, I signed the lease. So
it was a week.
It was a week.
And and your friends, they didn't try to talk you out of it?
The friends joined me in the pursuit. And then once it was a very stressful opening that I funded out of money that I was able to save from working for Shell for a couple of years.
Right. Oil money, by the way.
Yeah, sort of oil money.
Is built a small amount of oil money. Now you know the true story.
But then they, about 2 weeks into operation, they quit. And so I was solo. And then I begged my girlfriend, who is doing research biology in San Francisco, to quit her job and help.
Really? So, yeah, really?
My wife today. So.
Oh, then that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
She's been here for the whole journey. Then mm-hmm. That's yeah, nice yeah, to yeah. hear. And what year was that?
That was 1994.
Okay. Wow. Okay, well, so there's your origin story. And I guess, you know, one thing that comes up, and again, I'm also have a lot of our conversation sort of still floating around in my head from before, but it seems like you're making choices that are very based on metrics. You were talking about how you decide how to spend money on marketing dollars based on research, right?
Yeah.
You can be very... my point is this, is like, I know you guys are, you've opened up or are about to open up a theater in Louisiana, right? In Baton Rouge? Or you already have it open?
Not doing Baton Rouge. We were going to do it. Correct. And then there was a theater that opened too close to where we were going to open. Okay. So we backed away.
All right. So. Well, it doesn't matter because it's still actually will sort of lead up to my point, which is you don't have one in New Orleans. So what goes into that decision? I know it goes into the decision of canceling it, but what goes into the decision of where you open it? Because I would think, oh, well, New Orleans makes that. Why Baton Rouge?
Well, we're looking everywhere. We have a certain amount of theaters that we have the capacity to open just from our cash flow and equity that we have. So we're pretty opportunistic about it. Mm-hmm. We're certainly looking in New Orleans. Real estate's very hard to find. It's a big piece of land, needs a lot of parking. If it's an existing building, it needs 40-foot column spacing, which is very rare, when 25 to 35-foot high ceilings, which is also very rare. So you're either taking existing theaters or being part of a new development or taking some kind of like a big box, like a dead Bed Bath and Beyond or something like that.
Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
So many of these things now happening.
But you also have to be 3 miles away from another theater, just in terms of competitive film zones.
How official is that?
It's pretty official, but it's being investigated by the federal government right now for unfair trade practices, because the big boys have allegedly used it to their advantage over the years to kind of strong-arm the smaller players.
Right.
So we'll see. It might go all the way to the Supreme Court. It's being investigated right now.
Understood. Right. I didn't know if there was also maybe a youth market that existed there. I guess you're looking at every dimension of that decision. There's a lot of things going on around that decision.
Yeah. So I mean, we look for parking. We look for connectivity. So in LA, we have both parking and great subway connectivity. Mm-hmm. New York has incredible subway connectivity. A lot of just demographic data about the neighborhood that we get from a variety of means. I mean, my engineering background, I think, instilled in me
a
very quantifiable problem-solving methodology. So I love data. We collect a lot of data, and we use it to inform all of our decisions.
Makes sense. And so, like, in Brooklyn, I can't imagine you're 3 miles from a theater. Does it not?
It's a little bit different.
Different
than
in the center of a major metropolitan region, right?
Right. We're closer than that to BAM, but and there's one theater that's close, but it's like 2.5 miles, and we're going to be fine.
The location is. I remember at one point, I think it was like DeKalb and Flatbush, right over there. Is it still? That's still the location.
That's it.
Okay. Yeah, I know it well. That member, I mentioned this internet radio spot my show started on. That was at the time the developer had an agreement. This is years ago, that they would leave this lot available for a certain number of years. They ended up not doing that, but that's a different conversation for a different time. And they opened up a kind of like a market in there for a while called the DeKalb Market, and it was retrofitted storage containers.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, I went by there.
Oh, you did? Oh, when it was still there? Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was called the DeKalb Market. And one of those storage containers was this radio station. So it was very cool and a very neat space to do it. But then I remember after it moved and it was closed down and all that, but, you know, that draft house was going to go into that space. So it's a great location, actually, I think.
Yeah, we've been, working on it for almost 5 years, maybe a little bit longer.
Really?
So it was... more speculative, you know, before Barclays Center came up, and then there's condos everywhere, so it's a radically changing neighborhood.
It really is. It's so quickly it's morphing into something else. But they say that about Austin all the time, too.
Sure. And this is, too. Yeah. I mean, we just opened up a theater in the Mission District in San Francisco, and that's one of those hotly contested gentrification situations in the country. It's a tough one. But there we opened up a classic theater. It's a 1914 theater, so we're not really gentrifying. We're just bringing back something that was there for 80 years. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's some of the people listening. I have a feeling a lot of my audience has been to a draft house. I could be wrong. But it wasn't until I got to South By a few years back, or 5 years ago, where I had the first experience there. We have the Nighthawk, as you know, which has adopted this model that you clearly invented. How difficult was that to get off the ground, this idea of serving drinks and food? I imagine the idea of serving drinks is never that hard, but what do I know?
Well, the biggest challenge was it was my wife and I doing it, and we didn't have any experience. So my wife got a job waiting tables at a hotel breakfast shift, and I got a job making pizzas at a local pizza place. And from that, we kind of cobbled together our strategy.
Really?
Yeah. So we were woefully unprepared to do it. We didn't have any restaurant experience, period. So we probably got pretty lucky that it all did come together, and we made some good hires in the beginning.
Well, that's another whole thing, too, though, when you're talking about designing these theaters, you're also talking about a kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Very elaborate kitchen.
Right. That has to operate very quickly, very smoothly, right? I can't imagine what goes into those. I can't get into it because it would be a bear. But, like, you know, the idea of, like, how you work around the schedule of each theater and, you know, in there, data, once again, becomes very important to you, right? Because you got to know what you're ordering for, like, and be able to predict the eating habits and the amounts and quantities and all that, right, that go into feeding the movie audiences, right?
Oh, yeah. From scheduling appropriately to ordering appropriately to staggering your show times appropriately so you don't overburden the kitchen. It's a delicate art.
Does the festival, meaning South By in this case, throw that all into the, you know?
That's about the same.
Okay.
I mean, we work with South By on their schedule so that they don't destroy us. They don't start everything at once.
Yeah, right, of course. So moving into Drafthouse Films, which again started what year? You said it during the 2011? 2011, you said. I think that's what you said. Your first one was this, you mentioned this documentary. It was a documentary?
No, narrative.
It was a narrative. Yeah, it was a comedy. Okay.
It's Four Lions. It's from Chris Morris, who's a somewhat famous British TV personality. And he does a lot of political satire. And this was a continuation of that.
I see. Going into Drafthouse Films, did you also have the idea of what a Drafthouse film would be? Or is it more based on taste? And
it's based on taste. We only really wanted to work on movies that we fell in love with. And so that's been a pretty diverse slate. So we've done some challenging documentaries. We've done some repertory classics.
Right. Joshua Oppenheimer, you obviously developed a close relationship with him.
Yes.
Since he's I think both of his films.
Yes. We did the first one. We got along
well. Act of Killing.
And then we went back with The Look of Silence this year.
What goes into that conversation with Joshua Oppenheimer, for instance? Because it just seems like he, you know, going with, I don't know, it would seem there may be a couple of other distributors that might have, you know, come to mind that would have, with a track record on doing political documentary like that.
Yeah. Well, with The Act of Killing, you know, I watched the film and I was just shattered by it. And we put in an offer, and there were other offers out there. And then the sales agent told us that they were going with another company. And I did two things. One, I wrote a very passionate letter to Josh, telling them that I thought he was making a mistake, and this is why. And this is, it went into elaborate detail about how we were going to position and market the film. Mm-hmm. And then I also found out that the film was having its Danish premiere, because it was a Danish-funded film, the next night. And the moderator of the Q&A was this gentleman, Mads Brügger. And so Mads had done a documentary that we distributed called The Ambassador, which was a very challenging film from a legal standpoint, because there was no clearances. It was all filmed with hidden cameras. And I asked Mads, it's like, I think Josh just doesn't know who we are. Can you explain our working relationship and how we handled your film? Because he was very happy with what we did with The Ambassador.
Yep.
And so he did. So one of those two things, or the
combination
of them, made them change their mind, and they gave it to us.
Right. And let's talk about also Fantastic Fest, because that's the least, the thing I'm sort of the least familiar with, because unfortunately, up to date, I have not been to a Fantastic Fest, which is something I'd like to correct as quickly as possible, because I hear nothing but great things about it. And a friend of mine, Alex Calvo, or AD Calvo.
Sure, he was here this past year.
He was here last year, and he had nothing but really positive things. He was very excited to have his, I think probably more so than almost any other festival. Maybe TIFF might have been.
Fantastic Fest, it was inspired by a Spanish festival, Sitges, which is the oldest genre film festival in the world as well. It celebrated its 50th anniversary a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So genre meaning horror, science fiction, fantasy, action, and
exploitation,
weird movies.
Yeah, right.
It's for us, it's largely foreign language, so probably 80% of the films are from overseas.
Is that right?
It started as a regional festival, and then its notoriety grew. There were some sales that happened out of it. Troll Hunter happened out of it. Time Crimes. Some cool indie movies. Magnolia's bought a number of movies out of the festival.
Yeah. They have a magnet releasing.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which my new distribution partner, Tom Quinn, he started Magnet.
So he did.
Yeah. He was working at Magnolia when we first started working together.
Oh,
he was at Goldwyn before Magnolia.
Right.
So yeah, now it's a 8-day film festival. It has 75 features, about 50 shorts. We have a co-production market. There's emerging Latin American filmmakers come in with works in progress or just pitches, and we pair them together with financiers and people interested in that space. And then we throw crazy parties every night. That's another signature thing we do there, just a bunch of really different, odd spectaculars.
Yeah. I had no idea that such a high number were foreign language. Is it because genre films in the States are just underappreciated or underfinanced? We know that American films are underfinanced, and that in a lot of the countries, foreign countries, there's some sort of subsidizing going on.
Yeah, there's no quotas. So it really just boils down to what we like.
What you like and don't like.
Mm-hmm. And there's, unfortunately, there's a lot of bad genre filmmaking in the United States. And so it's partially fueled by that there is a commercial market for movies that I'm completely bored by. So straight-ahead slasher movies and, movies that go to the American film market, sort of what used to be considered the straight-to-DVD market, which are more kind of crass exploitation movies. I love exploitation movies, but they have to be done with heart. And but if you're making a cheap cash-in movie, I'm not interested.
Right, and you can sniff that pretty quick, right?
Yeah.
To respect your time, we're going to wind down in a second. But I can't get through this without talking about Roar, because it is possibly of all the films that I've seen in the last few years, and it's not a new film, it's actually an old film, but it is maybe the most bizarre, disturbing, and entertaining.
It's nothing like
but
it.
I cannot sit through the whole thing without taking breaks. I cannot
watch. It's white knuckle, isn't it?
It's
crazy.
It is. It's like, because it's just like, I know these people are being torn to shreds during the film. But very briefly, it's Tippi Hedren.
Tippi Hedren and her husband, Noel Wagner, their passion project. They started working on this in the early 70s, and it took them 10 years to make. They started collecting lions.
Big cats.
Big cats. They lived with them in Beverly Glen, and just in a beautiful home in Beverly Glen, they would always have three or four lions inside the house. And then when they would find more lions, then they set up a preserve and up in the foothills going up the Grapevine in L.A. So all this was in service of filming this movie about a family living with a pride of lions that they obsessively got into their head that they wanted to do. And it's absolutely bananas. I mean, people were hurt. Nobody was killed, thank God.
Right, but just barely.
Melanie Griffith was mauled. And
so if you're wondering why she started having plastic surgeries, you can't blame her. I know, but I'm allowed to make the joke. But no, I mean, it's just very true. And then there was a near scalping, or there was a scalping, right?
Yeah, Jan de Bont got 184 stitches. He was scalped. He was kind of hidden under this tarp while this camera was going, but the lion was attracted to the movement, and he couldn't really see it, and it just...
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's why you should, you know, it's interesting. It might not happen if he's just in plain sight of the cats, because they can get excited, but if they're well fed, they're not going to probably try to do too much damage to you.
But sometimes a playful little tap from a lion can do a lot of damage.
As you can see in this movie, and I don't know how people are able to see it, but... You never released it. You just...
Yeah, we did. Olive Film. So we ran the whole theatrical and the marketing campaign. It's out on DVD and Blu-ray now. I'm sure it's on iTunes. I don't know. It was such a pleasure to work on because it never actually came out in theaters in the United States. Noel Wagner was basically a con artist. And so he kept on needing more money for this film. And the last deal he did, the payback was triggered by the first day of theatrical release in the U.S.
Yeah.
So he just decided not to do it. It was $2 million, and he knew that he was not going to make $2 million. So he just kept it and walked away and cheated his investors.
I see. This is the case where the actual making of or a documentary about the film, would do incredibly well commercially. Where the original is almost like, you know, never going to.
But, it did well for us. We got lots of screenings out of it. So
I bet. Again, I get the idea that it's like all the challenges it offers for you is part of the gratification, absolutely the gratification of it.
And I heard about that film just randomly. I was at the Telluride Film Festival. I was going to see one of their classic films. I just started talking to a guy in line as a filmmaker, and he knew of some of the repertory things we've done before, Miami Connection being one of them, and he asked me if I'd ever seen Roar, and it's like, I've never heard of this. And he told me the story, and that's when I started the hunt.
I think you also loved the idea that you hadn't heard of something.
Yes.
And you didn't know, how could that be? And now there was like a gem there out there that you could be introduced to.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And
thank you. It's a pleasure.
I appreciate it. One other thing I meant to talk about, you know, I don't know if you've watched or heard about this new Louis C.K. show. You can stream it off his website. It's called Horace and Pete, and the whole thing takes place in a bar or upstairs primarily. Most of the scenes take place either in the, although there have been a few exceptions, it's sort of done, it feels like you're watching a play, and indeed a lot of the actors on the show are seasoned stage actors in addition to other work. Steve Buscemi is a regular, Alan Alda has been a regular, Jessica Lange. It's an incredible, really remarkable cast. Edie Falco is on the show. Stephen Wright is on the show. Tom Noonan, who was recently on this podcast and who is expected to be back soon, was on the show a number of times. And, you know, my ex-wife, Karen Pittman, who is a rising star herself, is his current love interest on the show. It's true. You can check out the show, and it's $3 a show. But I recommend it. You can see the entire series off his website. He's doing something that very few are. It's a little bit bleak, I will admit. It's like a kind of a comedy drama, but it's heavy duty. You know, there's a lot of drama going on in this show. It's still Louis C.K., and I think he's experimenting, and, you know, bless him for doing so. But it was interesting to see the woman who I was married to now kind of on the show as his love interest. But, you know, I'm giving my endorsement to the show. Please do check it out. We'll have Tom Noonan back on to talk a little bit more about the show and his experiences on it soon. In the meantime, I do want to say, if you could, speaking of Tom Noonan, to check out his films. They're on Vimeo On Demand. He has three films he's directed. One is called What Happened Was. Another is called The Wife. And the third is called The Shape of Something Squashed. I recommend you try to see as much of those three films as you can in the next couple of weeks before Tom comes on, because we're going to talk about those films with Tom very shortly. And I'm looking forward to that. We also have coming up on the show, for 24 years, he was a critic at Entertainment Weekly magazine. He now writes criticism for BBC.com. Owen Gleiberman will be on the podcast. He has a new book called Movie Freak, and he'll be talking about that and much more on the next episode of the podcast. Still coming up soon is John Turturro, actor, filmmaker, extraordinaire. John Turturro will be coming up shortly on the podcast. The Scandinavian filmmaker Joachim Trier's will be on the show soon. And he's got a new film with Jesse Eisenberg and Gabriel Byrne, which I loved, called Louder Than Bombs. And also, we're going to have Anderson Cooper and Liz Garbus on the show with their new documentary that's going to air on HBO. It's called Nothing Left Unsaid, and it explores Anderson's relationship with his mother, Gloria Vanderbilt. And it's a great documentary. I watched it the other night, and I was very moved by it. Anderson also has a book coming out on the subject, and so we'll get to all of that in the next couple of episodes. Thanks, everybody. We're getting closer. We're going to do a Kickstarter shortly. I'm actually getting my eggs in a row. We should have that up in the coming days. So we'll make an announcement about that probably on the next show, I hope. In the meantime, of course, you hopefully are subscribed to our podcast, and you can do that most easily, of course, on iTunes, although we're also on Stitcher, and, of course, we're on the Rooftop Films website. However you do it, just take the time to go to iTunes, though, and give a star rating to us, and maybe leave a nice comment about your feelings and thoughts about this podcast. And thank you very much for that. My name is Adam Shartoff, the name of the show, Film Wax Radio. Until next time, take care.